Hello and welcome to All Lit Up with me, Gilly Fogg, head creative at Lighthouse Studios in Kilkenny, Ireland. Our very special guest today is Lisa Hannawalt of BoJack Horseman and Tuca and Bertie fame. This chat about the highs and lows of being a showrunner is one we're going to dive straight into, and I think you're going to love it. So let's get all lit up. Lisa Hannawalt, it is so lovely to have you sitting right across from me in person. Thank you for coming all the way to Kilkenny, Ireland.
Thanks for having me.
Your first time in Ireland?
Yes.
But not your last.
No, I'll come back. It's very charming.
Wonderful. And wonderful. Here we are in the Lighthouse Studios Library, which is a real treat. Lisa, you are accomplished, multi-talented, and what I thought people, our listeners to this podcast, might be really interested to hear is about when people like you, who are, as I say, accomplished and skilled, get a little bit out of your comfort zone. Are you willing to go there?
Yeah, of course.
Great.
I'm rarely in my comfort zone. I was kidding.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. Because what struck me was that when you were working on BoJack, which went for six series, and I think you worked on all six series.
Yes.
While in the beginning you were, it was like your first, am I right in saying it was your first job on a big animation show?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Up until then I'd never worked on a like big collaborative project at that scale at all.
And then at the end you were probably leading a team of how many people?
Oh, on Tuca? Or on BoJack? Yeah. I don't even know. I mean, there were character designers, prop designers, background designers. Like, yeah, it was a huge team.
And were you art directing that as
yes,
well?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So very hands-on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And were you reading scripts?
Yes. Yeah, and going to table reads and yeah, breaking down, like, the character designs and...
Oh, okay. So yeah. At what stage in BoJack did you get into the story and the scripts?
Right from the beginning. Yeah, like, I worked on the original pilot for the first episode. We did, like, a 10-minute presentation episode to sell the show to Netflix and, yeah... I was on board from the beginning.
And, or I'm sort of saying but here, you were like, Lisa, can you please read this? Can you read this script and comment on it? You weren't creating the script for BoJack.
No. And I wasn't commenting on the writing.
Okay.
I mean, you know, occasionally Raphael would be like, what do you think is better, Quentin Tarantino or Quentin Tarantulino? I would say, let's go with Tarantulino. I haven't drawn a spider yet. But yeah, I wasn't in the writer's room and I wasn't like making notes on the script at all. It was more just, you know, seeing what the breakdown of characters was and
okay,
talking to Raphael about the characters.
And then you get to, not suddenly, because these things are a lifetime of work, and how Tuca and Bertie got to be greenlit is a whole other story.
Yeah.
But you get to the green light of Tuca and Bertie, which is your sole creation, your own creators, characters.
Yeah.
And then you are in a position where you're being asked and expected to lead the writing room.
Yeah, which was really scary. And I didn't feel prepared or like I knew how to do it. But, you know, I developed the show very slowly over the course of a few years with Raphael. And then, you know, in the first few weeks of writer's room, he was there and I had like writers who were experienced and kind of knew the ropes. And so it actually wasn't as difficult as I feared. And it was nice to like get started and be, you know, anxious, but then to realize like, I know all the answers. Like I know the story I want to tell. I know the characters front and back, like, or if I don't know the answers, at least I know how to figure it out. And now I have this room full of people here to help me figure it out and to help flesh out the story that I want to tell. So yeah, it was great.
Was it a big journey from that springboard to the final script?
Yeah, because I'd never written a script before. And so I kind of had to learn like, oh, you don't just start writing a script. You start with like the weird little scraps of notes that you've scribbled down, sometimes on napkins, sometimes, you know, hopefully in a dedicated notebook or on the computer. It makes it just easier to organize everything. And, you know, I look through my sketchbook and just kind of like start putting things together into piles, like, okay, this belongs with this, this idea goes with that, these two things pair together, and then I dream of a third idea that makes it really work. It's such a messy process, And then, yeah, slowly from there, build into the characters and the stories and the arcs and the things that actually I really want to tell, and then structure that into, you know, a season, and then break it down into episodes. And it's all just like, it takes such a long time, and it's about sort of like making the clay before you sculpt the sculpture.
And I mean, you are a Californian through and through.
Yes.
You studied in UCLA?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I studied studio art.
There is a really set way to do these things in LA, right? You've got the hero's journey. You've got Dan Harmon's famous story wheel.
Right, his story circle, yeah.
Three-act structure.
That's right.
So as a designer coming to a writer's room for the first time, were you like quickly looking up a hero's journey, or were you just like, listening?
No, in the opposite, actually. I was kind of obstinate about it at first, where I was like, ugh, I don't need a three-act story structure. Like, I don't need an A plot and a B plot. That's so boring. I'm going to, like, not do that. And then as I discovered along the way that, no, it's actually really helpful to have this framework. And without it, the story kind of falls apart, or it's, like, not satisfying to follow it through. You know, there's different variations of it. Not everything has to be the hero's journey or the circle or whatever. Everyone has their own version. But there's a reason why it's done that way.
It's true. I think a lot of people do that. You know, you hear about all of these things we've just mentioned, the three-act structure, and you go, oh, I'm going to break.
Yeah.
I'm going to break it. Mine's going to be different. But just like, you know, Picasso was an incredible
figurative painter. Yeah, before he went abstract. Exactly. There needs to be like an underlying grounding structure to things that like humans communicate a certain way. And there's a certain kind of structure that goes, that just triggers the like story in people's brains so that they know, like they can follow it. And the shorter the thing is, the less you have to follow a structure. But like doing a half hour, you know, episodes, actually they were closer to 23 minutes each, but that's long enough that you need an underlying structure or people are going to start to get really, really bored watching it. Mm-hmm. It's just going to feel like nonsense. It's too random.
And the other element is that you are developing these characters within that time frame, but your particular genre, which is adult animated comedy, it really, like, there are also rules applying to how often broadcasters want the audience to laugh, or even as creators.
Yeah.
Like, how did you get the funny in there, as they say?
I mean, first we just did it naturally. And then Netflix did ask for more jokes per minute at a certain point.
Jokes per minute, yes.
Yeah, because they kind of, like, panicked about it being funny enough. So we had to kind of go back and cram more things in after it was already animated, which was tricky. In the first episode in particular, after that, they calmed down.
So hold on. So you've got a finished episode, mm-hmm. which you presumably are really pleased with. It's like you've sweated blood and tears to get this finished episode.
I mean, by the time it was finished, I couldn't even like see it anymore. It was because we'd overworked the first episode so much. So even today, I couldn't tell you, like, it's hard for me to watch the first episode. The first episode, like, I was learning how to make a TV show. So I feel like it doesn't find its footing until like halfway through the first season.
So you had fully animated it?
Yeah.
And then they say, can you add more jokes?
Yeah.
What did you do? How do you do that?
We had to add more jokes. So we had to go back in and quickly reanimate parts of it. And just, we added, I don't know, the things we added were like, we added like speckle tripping and falling and spilling a bunch of stuff. Like it was just like absurd things that we hoped would result in a hard laugh, which is what they wanted, hard laughs.
What is a hard laugh? Did they define that?
I don't know. It's like, I think hard comedy is like, you know, a guy getting hit in the crotch with a football. It's like,
oh, right.
Just that's like so really basic human humor. I don't know.
And so you had to open, like, because the way animation is produced, it's like the cake in the oven.
Yeah, it's like setting cement.
Yeah.
We had to drill it back open and kind of add stuff in. And
that must have been the very opposite of funny.
Yeah, it didn't feel good. Whatever. I mean, we were lucky that we didn't have to like reboard very much at all. The show was mostly, mm-hmm. you know, published as intended, but yeah.
And then while the way animation series work, while you're getting episode one, hopefully finished, episode 7 or 8 is still in a scripting stage.
Yeah, or at least we wrote it pretty quickly.
Okay.
So by the time episode one was finished, like episode 7 or 8 would probably be close to done as well. Or like,
so did you have to go back and add hard laughs to everything?
No, only the first episode.
See, so it was
because the way their algorithm works, they were worried about people like watching the whole way through the first episode.
Can you explain that a little more?
Well, I don't really understand how their algorithm works, but it was like this many people watched 70% of the first episode and then they turned it off. That's like the number they gave us or whatever. So yeah, they're really concerned about retention through that first episode.
To go back to the whole writing process, by the end of it, or now that you've done how many seasons of Two Come Bertie?
3.
Yeah. So
the first season's on Netflix, and then the second and third season are on HBO Max and Adult Swim.
And still available to view globally.
That's right.
And having created a show, does it make you feel more confident about bringing, or how much of a personal experience do you find it's important to bring to your work?
It's all of my work is very personal, but in a sort of allegorical way where I'm like creating characters based on me, but also based on other people. And like, there's not like a one-to-one, like this person is me, this person is, you know, my boyfriend or whatever. But I'm taking inspiration from everything that's happened to me personally and kind of spewing it back out again. Yeah. Write what you know.
Write what you know. Yeah. We ask every guest on this podcast to choose a short film, and or it could be like a game or an app even. And Lisa, what have you chosen?
The app Instagram. No, I'm kidding. I hope it's not weird to choose my own video. I just was thinking about it recently. I rewatched it. A music video I did for Tegan and Sarah called Hang On to the Night. And they asked me to do this. I don't remember what year it was, but I did it while I was on hiatus from working on BoJack. And I feel like it kind of helped me sell my own show because it was like kind of a proof of, I don't know, something. Like it showed how my work is different from BoJack. It's more surreal. There's plant people. There's like boobies. Like, I learned a lot while working on it.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And Please, listeners to this podcast, please go to the link and click on it because it is just pure joy and it is pure Lisa Hannawald. The imagery, you're just all over it. And
yeah.
I love the story of how it came to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because who contacted you to do
it? Oh, Sarah. So yeah, Tegan and Sarah followed me on Twitter at the time. Back when I was on Twitter, they liked my comics and they, you know, we'd had one of their songs on BoJack and, but I hadn't really ever talked to them. But then Sarah just DM'd me out of the blue and asked if I would do a video. She said, we were doing videos for every song on this album and, you know, here's our budget. And I just said, yes. But I did not know how to animate. I'm not an animator. I've never studied it. So I just kind of like boarded it out in my sketchbook, and then I learned how to use After Effects, and I boarded out a loose animatic in Photoshop just by making a million drawings and kind of piecing them all together in After Effects. And then I hired animators to help me actually animate it. So like Nicole Stafford was a main animator on the project, and she really helped. Like she basically acted as a producer because she organized all the shots in a spreadsheet and like figured out what I needed to get done by when. And I realized I need that. I'm not the most organized artist. But yeah, it was a really, really fun project.
Yeah, because it was like a Lisa Hannawald Studios production.
Yeah, basically the one thing that I've done. It was like a tremendous amount of work. Like absolutely just 3 months of nonstop drawing and animating and learning how to use After Effects. So yeah, I don't know if I could easily do something like that again, but it was really great.
I think wonderful to do because, you know, a lot of people have their animation journey starting as an animator or in the story department, but it is unusual, I think, to be a creator and then, oh, I'll try animating.
Yeah, well, I just thought like well, I draw and I know how to make things move, like I can make GIFs, so how hard could it be? And I realized like 3 minutes of animation is actually like a pretty long amount of time if you're doing it by hand. And there's parts of the video where it looks a little rough, like there's like trees like tracking over the hill, like as the horse is like walking over the hills, and there's these trees like kind of moving backwards in space, and it's like really kind of complicated. And I did all of that by hand, like just learning how to animate from scratch. So it looks a little chunky and clunky, but like, that was my first attempt.
Yeah. And I think there is something, you know, even we're here, sitting here in Lighthouse Studios, it's a huge building that is filled with hundreds, you know, when we're in production, hundreds of people all in the building, all creating. And it's, the atmosphere is wonderful. And if you've got, as a director, something to talk about with an animator, you can like walk and go and see them and face to face. Whereas with Tuca and Bertie, that was animated in Korea.
Yeah, we did some of the animation in-house, but then the last two episodes of it, seasons, the ones that I did with Adult Swim, it was during the pandemic, so I couldn't walk over to anyone and chat face-to-face. Like, it was really isolated.
And you, I mean, I think you'd lose something then. Do you think so too?
I think so. I mean, I'm proud of how those seasons came out, but it was really difficult. You know, we had the writer's room over Zoom, and I recorded actors in their closets, and yeah, it was wild. Yeah.
Did you, when you not tried to animate the Tegan and Sarah video, because you did animate it, you did and you succeeded, but did you get an insight into the level of performance and character that animators bring to your show?
Yeah, I mean, I think just being an artist, I kind of knew what it would take, but... I animated a sequence for Tuca and Bertie too. There's a scene where her and Kara are dancing and then Bertie comes into the dance and it's like all done by hand. And I did that. Because we were going to like farm it out. And then I just kept like thinking I should just do it myself because I knew exactly how I wanted it to look. And I wanted it to look very hand-drawn and I just thought it would be fun. So yeah, I spent like a month doing that.
And how did you, your amazing producer, clear your schedule to enable you to do that?
I was working on the show at the time, so I don't know how I did. I think I did it like over Christmas break partly. Yeah, somehow I had the time. I just did it. And I like filmed myself dancing and like drew it based on that and like drawing as a, you know, dancing as the different characters. Yeah, it was really fun. I was proud of that.
And, you know, when a show like Tuca and Bertie goes to Korea, and then when you get to do parts of it in the studio, does it make you feel like you should do it all in LA? I mean, what is that a discussion that people have about why are we sending our shows away?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a budget thing. It's definitely cheaper to animate in Korea, but then stuff does get lost in translation, literally, and like, you know, comes back and we have to adjust it the way we want it.
Did you go out to visit the studio?
No, I never have, actually.
Did you think about it?
I've never been. I would like to. It'd be fun.
It wasn't suggested?
No. I know we had other directors who went, and I've met the owners of the studio. They came to the US to visit. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's like a budget thing.
Yeah. And also you liked the work that came back and you trusted the process.
Yeah, that's just part of it. It's also, yeah, the manpower needed. Like, it's a lot of animators needed to.
Yeah.
Like, especially for Long Story Short, the new show, it's like a pretty big show. There's a lot happening in it. So we need help. We can't fit it all in-house.
So that's also being animated overseas.
Yeah, by Big Star currently, yeah.
Okay, so now you're on supervising producer and designer of Long Story Short, and you're on the second season, which is amazing. And
yeah.
Congratulations, it's such a gorgeous show, which spans many different timelines with the same family. It's fabulous. Do you miss not being in the writing room?
Sometimes. It's kind of a relief, honestly, to not have to worry about that on this show. I can just kind of clock in and do the art directing alongside Alison Dubois. She's art director on the show, and she worked on Tuca and Bertie and BoJack as well. Just a fabulous art director. And we share an office. But yeah, it's way less stressful not being showrunner. So yeah, I think I'm waiting until I have an idea that feels like worthy of that before I'm ready to like pitch again and go through that process again and try to showrun again.
Yeah, and maybe you'll go to a different network or a different medium, a different platform.
Maybe, yeah, if it seems like a, you know, quirky idea that's not going to sell in the, you know, the major markets, then I'll take it to somewhere else.
If it's not a premium cheeseburger idea.
Yeah, gourmet cheeseburger. Yeah.
That's which is big on the Netflix menu.
That's what Netflix wants.
Yes, yeah. That's wonderful. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Lighthouse, and all the Lighthouse listeners. It's a real pleasure to have met you in person.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And go and watch that Tegan and Sarah video. It is so good. Thank you, listeners, for being here with us as we beam out to you from Lighthouse Studios. Do come back and join us for another episode of All Lit Up.